This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of the World Wide Wave on joy.org.au.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community, this is the World Wide Wave. Joy 94.9, this is the World Wide Wave, live from Melbourne, Australia. I'm Tom, joined in the studio with both Matt and Squirrel. It's great to all be back in the same spot at the same time. How are you, gang?
Fantastic, and really looking forward to tonight's show.
Absolutely excited to be here and excited for our guest tonight.
Correct. This week, the World Wide Wave stops over in Myanmar. Some of you may know it as formerly known as Burma. Tonight, we speak with Benjamin Law, author of the book Geisha. We also find out how a gay child fits into the Burmese concept of family, and we leave you with a question to ponder as we get tonight's show going. What percentage of gay men in Myanmar are believed to be HIV positive? What percentage do you believe? But as always, we like to get things started with some music. And tonight, we're going to get things started with an interesting little girls group called Me and Ma Girls.
Which is a bit of a play on Myanmar Girls.
It is.
Myanmar Girls.
It is. And
Myanmar Girls.
Their first song here tonight, A Liar. See what you think.
Here on the World Wide Wave, Joy 94.9.
It's the World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9, the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time. And tonight we are in Myanmar, or Burma. Now, we've got a great special guest coming up. You might have some questions that you'd like to send in. You can send us an SMS on 0427 Joy 949, phone the front switch on 1300 Joy 949, or send us an email in the studio. That's onair@joy.org.au, and we're also live on Facebook. So if you search World Wide Wave or W3Joy, we would love to hear from you and maybe pass on some questions to Benjamin.
This week, World Wide Wave is in Myanmar, aka Burma, Burma, aka Myanmar. It doesn't look so good for the corruption rate. They are one of the most highly corrupt nations, according to the Corruption Percentage Index.
How does one calculate a Corruption Percentage Index?
I'm not exactly sure of that, but I can tell you out of 183 countries, they rank 180th.
Oh. Whoa.
So there are only three countries more corrupt, according to this index, than Myanmar.
And that's something that quite often happens in very poor countries, because where there's poor countries, you get lots of international assistance coming in, and that sort of opens the door for
little money
going to the
borrowing
family.
That doesn't get paid back. Correct. The country has been under military control since a coup d'etat in 1962. During this time, the United Nations and several other organizations have consistently reported that systematic human rights violations within the country, including genocide, use of child soldiers, systematic rape, child labor, slavery, human trafficking, and a general lack of freedom of speech within the country.
So not
You look totally speechless that list continues to go on and on and on.
It's just, I mean, I was going to crack a joke, but it's just not funny, is it?
It's not, unfortunately. Since the military began relinquishing more of its control over the government recently, however, things have gotten a little bit better. The nations and powers that be have lifted some of the sanctions, and they say that the government is now sort of moving away from the military, giving it a little bit to the people, so things may be looking better.
Well, they're definitely looking to attract more Western economic investment. I mean, that's the Aung San Suu Kyi. That's everything that's been going on there, so it makes sense.
Correct. Section 377 of the Penal Code prohibits homosexuality. Once again, a holdover from our friends of the British. Along with fines, the punishment can be up to 10 years in prison, up to 10 years to life in prison. Now, Section 377 criminalizes, quote-unquote, intercourse against the order of nature. It is said that these ambiguously worded laws are often used at whim to arrest, harass, and intimidate anyone suspected of doubtful acts. Or, unfortunately, our homosexual brothers.
Now, later on in the show, we'll be able to ask Ben Law, who traveled to Myanmar himself, about whether what's happening on the ground, is this actually the case?
In modern times, in current times, a little bit more positive things happening. In 2011, Burma got its first LGBT-targeted TV program called Colors Rainbow TV, which airs once a month online and focuses on LGBT news.
Oh, that's exciting. That's like us, but like online.
Channel 31. Now, the organization that produces the program does say that they get 3,000 regular viewers within Burma, but they admit that their audience is limited to those who can afford internet access and have electricity. It should also be noted that only 25% of the population are on the national power grid. So only 25% of the population even has access to electricity.
Yeah, this is a really, really poor country. They've, for a long, long time, they were completely closed. They shut out Westerners. So the basics that we would take for granted, there's no ATM machines in Burma.
There are no ATM machines.
You have to take in your own cash.
Burmese society is far more conservative than its more outwardly sexualized neighbor. We know them as Thailand. Both men and women wear long cotton sarongs, with women taking pains to cover their shoulders and chest. Premarital sex is frowned upon. It's common for people to believe. Listen. It's common for people to believe that a gay man had a bad relationship with a woman in his past life. So in this current life, he's being punished by being gay.
I don't think that's much of a punishment, actually.
Nor do I. I think it's sort of a... But at any rate...
I couldn't imagine anything. Oh, just kidding.
It's a common belief. It's a common belief that you did something in your past life, had a problem with a woman, so you've been sent back in this life to be even more confused, quote-unquote, by being gay.
Not to be slightly off topic, but you would be amazed how many people ask or think that about, like, well, I'd say for being a lesbian in this life, oh, did somebody rape you? I have been asked that several times in my life. It's just, so it's good to know that at least they're going to the previous life in Myanmar.
Correct. And one final note, because we're going to be talking about a little bit later in the show as well. The 17th of May, 2012, Burma held its first IDAHOT, which is the International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. So they finally were able to hold that. Looks like things might be changing for the better.
Is that the one where the oldest participant was 106 years old?
106 transgendered participant came and spoke at the gathering. I was speechless when I read that. 106.
You give her a round of applause just for getting up there.
70 years from now, I want to be doing that 70 years from now.
Ooh, yeah, 70 years. Anyway, moving on, let's jump back into some music real fast before we speak with Benjamin Law. Coming up shortly, we're going to have our next song, which I will try and pronounce it correctly. If it is incorrectly, I apologize. Sai Sai with We Ya D.
This is Audrey Gochran, the director of Amnesty International's Africa program on the World Wide Web.
Hallo en goedenavond. This is Elko, listening in from the Netherlands on World Wide Wave, the latest LGBT news and current affairs on joy.org.au.
This is the World Wide Wave, where tonight we are venturing to Myanmar, and we are very lucky to have on the show with us a comedian, columnist, author, and self-confessed Gaysian, Benjamin Law. Welcome to the show, Benjamin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. Where does the term Gaysian come from?
Look, I mean, for as long as I can remember, my friends have been calling me gay and Asian. They think it's just too many minorities in one, so the most convenient portmanteau is just to slam them together, I guess. Gaysian, it's a minority within a minority. It's a delicious dessert. I think a lot of gay Asian people will have this hurled at them because it just seems to go together so well. So it started off as a joke between my friends, but then as I was writing the book that I've written, Gaysia Adventures in the Queer East, where I travelled to seven different Asian countries and looked at seven different LGBT issues, I realised, actually, it's not a bad book title either.
And did you, was the idea behind the book to sort of discover what Gaijin meant?
In a way, I mean, there are a few motivations for the book. I mean, as you said, I'm gay and Asian myself, so a part of it was personal. When you're the child of migrants like I am, both of my parents are ethnic Chinese, my dad comes from China, my mum was born in Malaysia. You do often wonder what it would have been like if you would been born somewhere closer to where your parents were raised, if I'd been born in China, what my life would have been like, if I'd been born in Malaysia, what my life would have been like, and would I have even been openly gay as well. So there's a personal dimension there, and I guess there are other dimensions too. I'm a writer and a journalist, so I was reading a lot of news reports a few years ago about LGBT stories that I noticed seemed to all be set around Asia, and I thought, well, there are some interesting stories there. I think I want to pursue that. And then finally, of course, I think Gay's just a good book title, like I said.
It is. It's an excellent book title and an excellent book. Congratulations on it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, we're particularly focusing on Myanmar tonight. You've got a really light way of writing. You put lots of comedy and things in your book. But when you hit the start of the Myanmar chapter, it kind of becomes very very confronting and quite serious. Is that the way... Was that your first impression of Myanmar?
It was. I mean, it's funny. The way I've constructed the book is I start writing about more humorous stuff at the start of the book. I go to gay nudist resorts in Bali and I hang around a transsexual beauty pageant in Thailand. And Myanmar actually comes towards the end of the book. And someone said to me that they found the book getting more and more serious and more grim as it went along. And that was sort of my intent, because I want people to be able to read about these serious issues that I don't think a lot of us are prepared to really read about, especially if it's in a part of the world that we're not that familiar with. Before I wrote the book, I hadn't been to Myanmar before. When I went over there in 2011, it was still a time when it was pretty much impossible to get a journalist visa to go over there. So all the journalists I knew who had worked in Myanmar did what I did, which is go over on a tourist visa and lie about what you were doing there. And when I landed, I knew that the story I wanted to cover was this sort of untold story about the prevalence of HIV, especially in its MSM, men who have sex with men, population. And the thing about the problem in Myanmar with tackling this problem is they don't actually know how bad it is. They know that it's bad. The stats vary a lot. They know that the rates of HIV in that country are probably some of the worst in the region. But what's difficult, and what I started to find out once I touched the ground, is that there are a whole lot of different gender and sex identities in Myanmar that don't have any equivalents outside of the country. So it was quite hard for people to get their head around, for outsiders to get their head around what was going on in Myanmar. And certainly, I mean, after a while, I spent enough time in that country, and it seemed like there was so little sex education, so little public campaigns about how not to get HIV, how not to get sexually transmitted infections, that a lot of people were either HIV positive, or you had a lot of women who were constantly pregnant and or HIV positive themselves. So it was quite grim.
It's actually slated as one of the countries in the world with the lowest amount of funding spent on health. Is that something that the local people are conscious of?
I don't think so. I think for a long time, people in Myanmar have felt a little bit blocked out from the outside world. It's only in the past few years that they really feel like it's opened up. And of course, because more tourism is going over there as well, people are starting to learn more about the outside world. I think a lot of people don't have that much to compare their situation to. And you are right. I mean, Myanmar breaks a lot of records, one of them being that they're estimated to be one of the countries in the world to have spent the least money, you know, comparatively on its citizens' health than any other country in the world. And when you look even at just general standard of living, which is often measured by gross domestic profit per capita, their standard of living is estimated by agencies like the CIA to be somewhere between North Korea's and Afghanistan. So it's a pretty
low benchmark
already,
isn't it?
Yeah, and I didn't necessarily know that when I was going into the country, but once you're removed from it, you do realise there is a reason why people's health isn't isn't that great. And even when you do contract HIV over there, the sort of health options are very, very limited. And that's one of the big problems that I looked at in my book.
And now, Ben, you're talking about, in the book at least, you said at least 250,000 people are HIV positive. And one of the stories that stuck in my mind was the client was HIV positive, or the sex worker was HIV positive, and the clients didn't want to hear it, and they still were willing to pay, you know, an extra $10,000, just no condoms, don't want to use the condom, even though the sex worker was saying, I'm HIV positive, I'm willing to use a condom. The clients were turning this down. Can you tell us a bit about what's the mentality behind that? Why are they not using protection in that sort of situation?
It's fascinating, isn't it? I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that a lot of people in Myanmar don't really understand what HIV is. I think a lot of them think of HIV as AIDS, which is it's life-threatening, and you get to that point where you are actually dying, and that's what HIV is. They don't understand that if you're HIV positive, it doesn't necessarily manifest on the face or anything. So I think there's a basic misunderstanding with what HIV is. I think there's very, very little education about how to prevent HIV or what condoms do. I mean, condoms are freely available, but there's sort of a stigma around condoms as well, because you're not supposed to have premarital sex in that way, because there's such an absence of discussion about sex at all that no one's necessarily going to go out to a chemist or into the markets and buy condoms. And as for the sex workers themselves, I mean, one of the reasons why they'll say yes to unprotected sex, whether they suspect their client is HIV positive and they're not, or if they're HIV positive and the client isn't, one of the reasons they'll say yes is there isn't really this long-term living mentality in Myanmar. Life expectancy is short, and even if you don't die by disease or poverty, there's enough natural disasters going around to wipe you and your entire family out. So it's very much day-to-day living, hand-to-mouth mentality. It's like, what will get me to the next day? If it's sex work that's unprotected, then I'll do it.
So in a country where they estimate 29% of the gay male population is HIV positive, and that 20% of those infected with HIV have access to the antiretroviral treatments, what you're saying is that there's so much going on in a day-to-day battle for life that HIV is just one more thing in the pot to deal with.
I mean, look, my chapter focuses on HIV, but there's so much more going on there. Just access to good food, for instance. It's just this day-to-day slamming, and once they think they've actually got themselves on their feet, a huge hurricane might sweep 3 Myanmar. And the thing is, you're living in a country where the government isn't going to help you out. When we're talking about antiretroviral access, and as you said, about 1 in 5 people who need antiretroviral treatment will actually get a hold of it. Those sources for antiretroviral treatments aren't government sourced. They're largely sourced by MSF, Doctors Without Borders. And there actually came a point where one year MSF reached capacity. They couldn't actually supply enough antiretrovirals to the people who need it. They literally, and think of it, you've gone over to a foreign country as a charity worker to save people's lives, and you have to turn them away because it's a waste of your resources, because it's an ongoing treatment. And if you start treating more people, that means other people might die, so you actually just have to say no. It's this heartbreaking sort of situation for an overseas foreign charity to deal with.
And the situation outside of the cities is even worse. I mean, you were talking about condoms before, and there was one sex worker that you interviewed in a country area, and they hadn't even seen a condom.
No. I mean, this is the thing. When we're talking about a city, I mean, a city by Burmese standards in Myanmar is somewhere like Yangon and Mandalay. And even in those two cities, there isn't that much education about these things. So if you're living somewhere rural or regional in Myanmar, your education levels, and I'm not even just talking about sex education, I'm just going to be talking about education in general, is very, very low. There was one thing that I wrote about the book that didn't actually make it into the book, which was that I actually taught sex ed for a while in Yangon, the most, you know, populous city in all of the country, and so few of these adult men knew the fundamentals about
how reproduction worked, what safe sex was. So if you think about that, and that's the most popular city in the country, you're definitely not going to get any of that in the regions whatsoever. And if you live slightly outside of the cities, you're going to be taking really, really long trips to get onto antiretrovirals, and that's if you even know about them in the first place. I mean, I'm painting a very grim picture here, but when I went in 2011, that was a very particular time and place in Myanmar's development. Things have started to improve. I mean, in a way, I think when I went over, things were at such rock bottom that it could only get better. So, you know, it's sort of a dark positive spin, maybe.
So the grim picture is not that you were the educational future of Burma was in your hands. I'll just clarify that.
I'm not sure that's a positive spin either. There's only so much sex ed I can teach.
You did attend some doctor training. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the doctor training was interesting. That was started by, like all groups over there, it was either a community-based organisation or a non-government organisation, and I think that one was PSI, and PSI is doing a lot of great work in the country about making sure that antiretrovirals are cheap and accessible and educating people about safe sex. One of the seminars that they were running were for GPs in Myanmar. Now, there are actually a lot of doctors throughout Myanmar. It's not for want of numbers. The problem with a lot of GPs in Myanmar is that they probably only attain what would be the equivalent of a bachelor's degree in developed countries, and then they're suddenly qualified to work in that country with only a couple or 3 years training. And what was quite shocking was that when I went to one of their training seminars, these were all qualified doctors, qualified by Myanmar standards. They might have been in their 40s or 50s, so obviously they'd been practicing for quite some time. And they were being introduced to a PowerPoint presentation about the fundamentals of diagnosing HIV. One of the things, especially in a country like Myanmar, where you would think, where you'd hope that they would know this stuff already, you know, stuff that I knew, not that I'm a medical professional at all, but how HIV progresses or at what point does it become AIDS. This is stuff that was brand new to them. So you just by seeing that, I just thought to myself, wow, they would have seen so many HIV positive patients in their time being a doctor, and they probably didn't even think to diagnose them. They probably didn't even know how to diagnose them.
Well, that's pretty intense information, or rather lack of information. Hey Ben, what we're going to do now is we're talking with Benjamin Law, the author of Geisha, and we're just going to hang tight for 1 second and hear a bit from some of our sponsors, but we've got a couple more questions for you, so hold on. Also, if anyone listening has any questions for Ben, feel free to SMS us at 0427-JOY949 or shoot us an email at onair@joy.org.au, and we're on Facebook on W3Joy.
This is Eve from Cameroon on Joy 94.9.
It's the World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9, and we are tonight speaking with Benjamin Law, the author of Geisha, Adventures in the Queer East. Benjamin, we touched on this before, sex workers. Now, sex work is, I guess, a fairly reliable form of income. In fact, it's a well-paying income in Burma.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's reliable, and in other ways it's like some of the most shoddily paid work that you could ever really come by. I mean, a lot of the young men especially will be recruited from the regions of Myanmar, or maybe they'll see an opportunity to come to the city, and they don't adjust. They might be working for restaurants or eateries that provide them accommodation, but literally work them around the clock with not much time for leisure or sleep. And then they might be kicked out, maybe they don't cope with the hours, and then they come across bridges. A lot of the sort of pedestrian bridges throughout Yangon and the bigger cities, you'll see a lot of sex work being traded, and they figure, well, this is something that I can do. Of course, they're not really educated about safe sex either, so they're putting themselves at huge risk. And they sometimes will get paid well by foreigners. They get paid pretty shoddily by locals. Sometimes on a bad night, I heard that some sex workers would settle for roughly, you know, 60 or 70 cents per hour as well. And because there's no, they don't have their own accommodation or lodgings, there's a hotel cost on top of that. So they really do get the raw end of the stick, so to speak. But, you know, sometimes there's no other choice.
And even for foreigners, you're talking about, you know, under US $10 for an hour with a local prostitute. So it's
pretty
horrific.
And look, that might even be on a generous end of the scale. I spoke to a few sex workers in Yangon, and those going rates would be the city rate. So when we're talking about a few dollars or maybe up to $10 an hour, that's for the city, and a lot of people would be selling themselves for even cheaper out in the regions as well.
Now, the you mentioned that you saw a male prostitute who looked as young as 12 or 14.
Mm.
What's the impact on how do families view their children who go out and undertake sex work?
I remember talking to one sex worker, and they define themselves as a pwint, which I guess is our equivalent to transgender. So even though biologically male, presented and lived as a woman. And she was talking about when she started doing sex work, and effectively her boyfriend slash husband, in air quotes, was pimping her out. And she was living with her family, and when they found out what she was doing, they were absolutely mortified, as a lot of families would be. But because then they saw that she was actually bringing in money, they never spoke about it again, and it was this silence, I think, not agreement and not acceptance completely. But the fact is, you know, when you're in a country like Myanmar, you really do need money, so you're going to accept it any way that you can. I mean, the tragic story of her life was that she actually saw one of her uncles die of HIV/AIDS as well. And when she was diagnosed as HIV positive, she just immediately flashed back to what had happened with her uncle and just thought, that's what's going to happen to me too. So you're stuck in a situation where her only avenue for earning money from then on was sex work. She knew no other way of getting work, at least work that was as regular or as reliable, but was probably, you know, within her mind, working herself into a grave and not sure about what antiretrovirals were, where to get them, or how. And also, you know, hearing that it was competitive too, once she found out where to get them from.
Yeah, so tell us more about the competition, because it is extremely, we spoke before that it's about one in five who need antiretroviral treatment that is able to get it. So four in five people who need it are not. How does competition play out?
I mean, in a way, this is one of the questions I first asked when I arrived in Yangon. I mean, one of the things that I did for each of the chapters that I wrote for my book, Geisha, was, you know, I often, when I come to a foreign country, especially one where I've never been to before, I try to find someone who's a professional who works in a field. And I had dinner with one gentleman called Sean Mint, and he had worked in the HIV sector for many, many years, decades. He'd even, you know, represented Myanmar in AIDS talks with the UN. And he sat me down and he was going through the figures, and he was saying, so these are how many people who need antiretrovirals, this is how many that Myanmar could probably roughly provide in a year. And as he was saying it, like, my mind couldn't even comprehend what he was talking about, because I said, no, just draw me a diagram. So if these are how many people who need it and these are how many you've got, what happens to the rest of these people, these, you know, as you say, four in five people who don't get them? And he just leaned in and he actually laughed, because this is the thing about Myanmar, you laugh at some pretty messed up stuff. He laughed and he just said, they die. So it's not, in answer to your question, in some ways it's not really a competition. In some ways what happens is those people who, well, some people are ruled out because they don't even know what antiretrovirals are and that they ever need them, and other people are ruled out because geographical access, they're just not close enough to the main centres like Yangon and Mandalay to get them. And then the other ones, I mean, some of them will get on them and some of them might not. Especially if an agency like MSF, you happen to come across them in a year where they've just hit peak, you just don't get them. You die.
There was also an odd, odd from my point of view, comment from one of the sex workers who didn't want to take antiretroviral treatment because of the side effects, because she feared that she would look older.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big thing. Antiretrovirals, they've been around for a while, but they're still fundamentally really harsh drugs. And I think people who have been on antiretrovirals will tell you it does actually affect things like your skin and how you look. And I'm not sure if the antiretroviral treatments in Myanmar are any different. I'm assuming not, but it does affect how you look. And some people that I spoke to who had been on antiretrovirals for a while, and plus, you know, it's probably to do with the conditions of their life as well, did look older than the age that they introduced me to. And some people, having had seen that treatment work on those people, they were far more scared of the effects of what would happen on their face than about living a long life. Keep in mind what I said before. I mean, in Myanmar, you don't really have that mentality about long-term living. It's about the here and now and survival. And especially if you're a sex worker, your looks are your survival. It's not just a complete vanity thing, you know what I mean?
How does
HIV affect somebody's work life? I recall that there was a gentleman that worked for the government department and he wanted to transfer so that he could have better access to treatment, and that didn't come across terribly well.
No, I mean, his situation was quite tragic. He had quite a professional job. He had opportunities to study abroad. And, of course, so many of these opportunities, job or study, they come through the government. And if you're found out to be HIV positive, as he did, I mean, he had to disclose it to one of his colleagues or professors that he was HIV positive, because he really needed help and he was scared. And then that word got out, and the official line that came back to him was, you can come back to work. I mean, you can't come back to work, but you can come back once your tests for HIV come back clear, which of course can't happen.
No.
You know, once you're HIV positive, they're not going to come back negative.
Is that to get rid of him or is that a pure ignorance of what HIV is?
You know, I think, you know, if they work at the government at that level, I would assume that they're not that stupid. I think it was a very clear way where they could say, look, we don't want you, and you can't work in this position any longer. So you're severely compromised and, you know, and shamed as well. How to have that conversation with your family? They might not even really have a vocabulary or knowledge of what HIV is. And so a lot of people will, as this guy did, he locked himself away after he found out he couldn't work for a while, until his immune system got quite compromised and a friend had to intervene for him. So your work security definitely does get compromised when you've got HIV there, as I think it happens in a lot of countries. If they find out you've got HIV, there's a huge stigma. I don't think you can go to any country in the world where there isn't a stigma surrounding HIV.
It's just curious, is there as big a stigma around being HIV positive, or is there as being homosexual?
That's a good question. I think, well, you know, their concept of homosexuality in parts of Myanmar is very, very different. They've got three sort of subcategories of homosexual, and I suspected that a lot of it was foreign to non-homosexuals within the country. So, you know, you've got, as I was saying before, a puint, which is, I guess, equivalent to transgender. You've got tangae, which is masculine and always on top. And you've got a bone, which is versatile, but your identity is not open with anyone else. So I think there's all those sort of different levels of gender identity that, I mean, I was barely aware of when I went into the country. And I don't think a lot of non-queer people in Myanmar are very aware of. I don't think there's a huge discussion about sexuality or gender identity. And like a lot of Asian countries I wrote about, I suspect that it was the case where a lot of people it was don't ask, don't tell, or getting involved in fake marriages, that sort of thing. But I think there is a huge stigma towards HIV just because it's non-discriminatory. Anyone could get it as well. I don't think they necessarily associate HIV just with being queer, as a lot of other countries might. I think they see it as this sort of illness. So there's probably more stigma around that, I imagine. It's more in the public imagination.
Your book, Geisha, Adventures in the Queer East, tackled a lot of countries. Was Myanmar the worst, you would say, for a gay person to live in?
I mean, this is a question that's come up a lot because as an Australian coming into different countries, what's better, what's worse, is there a spectrum? And in some ways I try to avoid the question because, you know, there's no country in the world where you could go to and say, well, it's gotten these things right on the checklist and these things wrong and therefore it's better than others. It's a little bit more complicated than that. At the same time, I have to say instinctively, in response to your question, yeah, I mean, it was the country that shook me up the most. It was the poorest country that I went to. It was the country that probably had the highest rates of HIV that I went to. I mean, they would probably say they don't have homophobia in the way that we know it. They don't have that vocal hatred of homosexual or queer people. But, you know, on the other hand, they've got this completely invisibilized culture of queerness and homosexuality. And I think that amplifies the HIV/AIDS problem. So in that way, yeah, it probably was the worst country that I visited with these issues.
So more of a perceptual question for you. Myanmar has formerly been known as Burma, and there is a tendency by most of the free Western thinking society to refer to it as Burma. But you specifically answered that question in your book as to why you chose not to refer to the country as Burma. Can you share that with us?
It's interesting. I mean, I actually change between Burma and Myanmar day-to-day speaking. The explanation that I give in my book is that, look, in Western publications, they actually change between Burma and Myanmar too. You'll have different usages between the New York Times and the Washington Post. I think from memory, the Washington Post uses Burma and the New York Times uses Myanmar. You'll have differences within Australian and UK publications. So it was interesting trying to figure out what I wanted to use. Someone like Aung San Suu Kyi, for instance, still uses Burma. It's often used by people in the Western free world, as you talk about, almost as a protest, because Myanmar has been for so long run under military rule. Why would you use the name that they've bestowed on the country themselves? I chose to use Myanmar because, first of all, I never heard it referred to Burma within the country, and you could argue that's because people were afraid to call it Burma. But even when I was having really private conversations with people who were very pro-democracy, they used Myanmar as well. It seemed like everyone there called it Myanmar. The second reason I would use it nowadays as well is that it's actually Australian government policy, and that changed at the end of the year to start calling it Myanmar. And that's actually to do with a lot of the reforms that have taken place since I was in the country and since I was writing the book. I don't think either option is wrong. I don't think either option is right in that sort of way as well. But Myanmar, I mean, that's what I use now.
We've been talking with Benjamin Law, author of Gaysia, Adventures in the Queer East, and you can find out many more stories about all over Asia in the book. It's a fantastic read, available at all good bookstores, I'm sure, and all gay bookstores for sure. Benjamin, we would love to have you back to talk with other countries at a future time.
Oh, I would love to do that. Look, that's one of seven countries I covered. There are six more to go.
What's your next project?
That's a good question. Gaysia is the second of two books that I've written, and the first book was a black comedy memoir that I wrote a few years back called The Family Law. We're developing that for TV at the moment. So we've got our heads down, bums up in screenwriting software, and we're sort of knuckling away at that. So that's the next one. And I'm starting to think about another book that would be another non-fiction sort of adventure book, but that's probably way further down in the pipeline.
Well, best of luck and thanks for being a part of the World Wide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been fun.
Hi, everyone. My name is Yang Fa from Singapore. You are listening to World Wide Wave on Joy. And lots of love to everyone at Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9. This is the World Wide Wave. And let's listen to some music. This is by Mae Sweet, arguably the most famous production to come out of Mainland. Joy 94.9, this is the World Wide Wave. That was Mae Sweet, arguably the most famous and commercially successful female singer in the history of Burmese pop music. A bit of country western theme, I thought, so I slid it in.
And, yeah, don't know that it'd take off here, but...
well, this is from the 80s.
From the 80s, really?
Yes.
Wow.
It's a bit of a flashback. Right. Country flashback, but... There you go.
And normally I love 80s music, but you know.
This week, of course, we are in, I will now try and say it for the rest of the show, Myanmar instead of Burma. Talking about how things are not so great. But as we always like to say, or we hope to show, things do have the possibility of getting better.
In fact, a quote from one of the activists in Myanmar, Aung Myo Min, he says, "The situation is changing. We can feel the wind of change, but we cannot see it yet." And I think that's quite
That is a
poetic.
Fantastic quote. But things do appear, at least on the surface, to be changing. As we said, in 2012, they had the Ida Hot, the first Ida Hot Day, International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. And you were also mentioning it when we were off air that they're trying to do something else in the coming year.
That's right. In 2014, Myanmar is hosting ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations conference and government forum. And they usually have some forums that sit alongside that, and they're pushing very hard to have one that focuses on LGBT rights. And I think that's something that the Southeast Asian nations and certainly Australia would get behind and support, no doubt, to bring that to a higher profile within Myanmar.
And for those of you joining us earlier in the show, we were talking with Benjamin Law, the author of Geisha, Adventures in the Queer East, and discussing what's a really, I'm going to use the word wretched, although they were laughing about it, but HIV and sex education and health in general system. Now, Ben had traveled around Asia to 7 different countries, and this one just came up on his scorecard as one of the most poor and just all around a very difficult place, yes, to be gay, but also to be HIV positive, where there's competition for drugs. It was striking to me that in his book he writes about when you have HIV and you get the drug treatment, it has to be the cases the most severe. Well, these are the people who are dying as well. Their numbers are dipping to under 100, and they're getting the drug treatment. Yay, they finally got the treatment, but it's too late to really be kicking in for them. And so,
Which is essentially wasting the treatment.
So in essence, it's just large-scale waste. And that just seemed to sum up what's happening right now in Myanmar. It just seems to be, I don't mean to be mean, but large-scale waste. So I know we were trying to end on a positive, but I have to say, I think what's positive is that they're starting to see the waste. It's almost like the pollution is helping them see the wind in their face.
And the international community coming in and not only bringing their money and their thoughts, but pushing for change. The government's started to make changes on a political level. So,
The people at the grassroots level, they want change as well. So it's not that they're not advocating as well. It's just that when will it all come together? When will the government change, the people's change, and the medical knowledge all come together? Watch this space.
It's been a fantastic show, and we very much thank Benjamin Law, author of Geisha, Adventures in the Middle East.
Hi, I am Fernando from Guadalajara, Mexico, and you are listening to Worldwide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9, Worldwide Wave. This week we have been visiting Myanmar. We had the esteemed pleasure of speaking with Benjamin Law, author of Geisha, Adventures in the Queer East. Do run out, pick up your copy. Of course, you can always definitely pick one up at Hares and Hyenas. Absolutely. In Melbourne here.
Or fantastic read. It's got my endorsement. I really loved it.
Correct. Thank you again. Can't thank you enough. We'll thank you a few more times, Ben, for having the time to chat with us.
And we've got a new show coming up following us. Amy's taking a break on this grid. So we've got the boys from the locker room, Ben and the team, standing outside in their footy shorts waiting to come on and give us the roundup of sports here on Joy 94.9.
I think I'm definitely going to be sticking around for that.
Just working back late tonight, are we?
A little bit, perhaps. Next week, where are we off to next week?
We're going to Malaysia. We've spoken to a gent in Malaysia, finding out a bit more about what's going on over there.
If you have any country that you know a bit more about, just let us know. Just like we heard from been about Burma today. We could also hear from you about anywhere that you're from. We're always interested. Some ways to reach us are to email us at worldwidewave@joy.org.au, or you can send us a Facebook message, W3Joy, and you can also catch us on Twitter, and that's at W3Joy.
As always, we thank you for riding the World Wide Wave. Until then, we leave you with Lin Lin Zero.
Catch you next week. Thank you for listening to the World Wide Wave podcast. We're always looking for interested guests and news tips. You can email us at worldwidewave@joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.